Well, thank you, Randy. And you've heard already the credentials of our guests, so it's possible, I guess, to add more layers onto what is already recognized as a highly accomplished scientist, theorist, and so on. But I put on my glasses. Old age has come upon me at last. And let me just add to some of the things that Dr. Gable and Brian Gaines have already said about Stuart's background. As you know, he was one of the founding members of the Santa Fe Institute and continues to be active in that environment. With Ernst & Young, he co-founded the BIOS Group, where he was chief scientific officer for 6 years. He is professor emeritus, as you've heard, of the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He has his BA degrees from both Dartmouth College and Oxford. He did an MD degree at the University of California, San Diego, and then went to Cincinnati General Hospital, where he did an internship. But as you've heard as well, he left human medicine for doctoring Drosophila and other organisms, where he's had more success, I guess, than doing the kinds of things that I've done in the past, too. But his professional activities include membership of the Planetary Protection Advisory Committee of NASA, Board of Trustees of the Santa Fe Institute. He was founding editorial board of Evolution and Development. He's founder of Cistern Molecular, founding general partner with Ernst & Young of the BIOS Group, founding editorial board of Molecular Diversity, founding member and president of Diversity Biotechnology Consortium. He's been a consultant to AFIMAX Research Institute, founder of Darwin Molecular, president of the Society for Mathematical Biology, consultant with the Los Alamos National Laboratory, co-chief editor of the Journal of Theoretical Biology, editorial board of the Quarterly Review of Biology. Moving on to page 2 of 10. I'll stop there. And if you have any doubts now, do what Dr. Gable did a few weeks ago. Go home and Google Stuart Kaufman, and you will come up with some amazing revelations about the quality of our guest and our new colleague, Dr. Kaufman, outranking in many categories such notable scientists, for example, as Richard Dawkins. So it is a great pleasure, again, to introduce Stuart, and we look forward to the scientific part of your presentation this morning. Stuart?
Well, I hope everybody got coffee. Before I start the science part, I want to say one thing that I forgot to say in my allotted 7 minutes. All of this is very orchestrated. I forgot to say that we have money from ICOR and the university at about $1 million a year, which is enough to support about 4 to 5 faculty members and around 15 postdocs and graduate students and technicians. We are, in fact, in competition with Harvard, with Princeton, and the others. Harvard will have a faculty of 20. The University of Manchester will have a faculty of 100. I am seeking to raise a total of $5 million a year and $5 million for renovations to build the faculty to about 10 to 12 and the total number of people to around 50 to 60. We're taking on vast topics. There are many people in this room who know as much or more about these topics than I do. I think that they would agree at the central importance of the problems, and I hope to be working with them in the future and learning from them. So I just wanted to make that piece of organizational announcement. Now, meanwhile, Marv pointed out to me that, or to you all, that I worked on fruit flies and I was a fruit fly doctor, and so I can tell you a little story. My then second grade daughter, it was in class, and they were filling out forms about what does your daddy do, and Merritt wrote down with some pride that my daddy's a doctor, and all of the other kids in the class said, your daddy's not a doctor, he's a fly doctor. So which is not true. I'm a real doctor, but I've forgotten an awful lot. The terrible thing is you remember your bedside manner. So you don't remember what the bedside manner is supposed to be for, but you remember how to say, "they're there," and things like that. So. But I do remember my science. So I want to try to place where the Institute lies and where modern science lies in a broad context to start off with. We have 300 years of reductionist science. That science has been spectacularly successful. We have, in that reductionistic science, taken systems apart into smaller and smaller parts. We've always known that we would have to put the parts back together again. Newton put the parts back together again. They're called planetary orbits. So it's not it's not a new idea. What makes things different now is that we have a computer, and the computer allows us to look at systems with very many interacting parts and to look at the collective behaviors of systems with very many parts. Therefore, the computer is a kind of macroscope that allows us to see emergent collective phenomena in complex systems. This is also my little lecture to my physics colleagues. I'm trying to seduce them in to come in and straighten out us dumb biologists. And, of course, biologists aren't dumb. Now, with that in mind, what I want to do is I want to tell you about cell differentiation and lead up to cancer and the other things that I was mentioning. Everybody in this room started as a fertilized egg. If you didn't, please leave. Okay? It's possible. It's possible in some organisms, but not in humans. So you're really weird if you didn't start as a fertilized egg. That cell divided about 50 times to give rise to the newborn baby. But the cells became different from one another, liver cells, kidney cells, spleen cells, and so on, in a process called cell differentiation. By expert count and unquestionable authority, we have 265 plus or minus a couple cell types. That's on morphological, histological criteria, not on molecular criteria. Now, the question is, why are cells different from one another? It used to be thought it was because different chromosomes went to different cells, but that proved false. Then it was found that cells are different because different genes, as you remember, genes make RNA make protein. Different genes are active in different cells. So in red cells, you get hemoglobin, and in B cells in your blood, you get antibody molecules. Jacob and Monod, two French geneticists in the early 60s, changed the field entirely by discovering something quite fantastic. They discovered that the protein made by one gene could bind to a DNA region next to a second gene and turn the other gene on or off. In bacteria, they're called operons. You are entitled to picture the 30,000 genes in each of your cells as comprising some vast parallel processing network in which genes are turning one another on and off, up and down, in a way that coordinates and is marshaled into organization in the development of the fertilized egg into you, the newborn baby, and the adult, and goes awry in cancer and underlies stem cell behavior, to which I'll get later. Now, Jacob and Monod wrote a second paper. They said, look, suppose I've got two genes, A and B, and A turns B off and B turns A off. Then that little circuit could have two steady states, A on, B off, or B on, A off. And that could support two cell types given the same genome. They set the field afire. Now, I'll come back to that in a moment. But first, let's imagine we're considering not 30,000 genes, but three genes, A, B, and C. And we plot the level of activity of A along the floor this way, B along the floor that way, and C going up to the ceiling. So we have a three-dimensional coordinate system. Newton taught us how to think about this. If you release the system from some combination of the gene activities of all three genes, and if that's all there is to the story, these three genes, the system will follow some pathway in this state space, and will the pathway is called a trajectory, and the system will end up on something like a steady state where it stops changing, or what's called a limit cycle oscillation where an oscillation happens, or what's called a chaotic or strange attractor, and so forth. Now, I'm going to return to this in a minute. Well, I'll say it right now. Jacob and Monod's A on, B off, and B on, A off are examples of exactly the same kind of steady states that I was just talking about. They're called attractors. And it's a very attractive hypothesis that among the possible patterns of gene activities in your cells, cell types correspond to the attractors of this parallel processing dynamical system. It's a very attractive hypothesis, but it's a hypothesis. We don't know that it's true. Okay, so I want to give you an analogy to think about for these trajectories and so on. Think of a mountainous region with lakes and streams flowing into it, and lots of lakes and lots of streams. The set of streams that flow into one lake are like the trajectories flowing to the attractor, and the lake is like the attractor, and the different attractors are like the different lakes. Now, if cell types are these lakes, then what's cell differentiation? Well, cell differentiation is a process that gets you out of one lake, up over a pass, and flowing down a stream into another lake. So cell differentiation is a process of changing attractors in this picture. Okay? Now I want to talk about, and I better put on my glasses because I'm not used to being able to read my own writing. Okay, so I've talked about cell types as attractors and differentiation. Now, the next thing we have to talk about is that cells are in fact not deterministic dynamical systems. They are inherently what mathematicians call noisy. That means that if you look at a cell, the number of copies of a given molecule that controls a gene activity may be 2 or 3 or 4, not millions. And that means that there are intracellular fluctuations in the activities of different genes. And that means that the cell is a noisy or stochastic dynamical system. Okay, what do we know about cell types as attractors given noise? And the best data is old data. It's due to Neubauer and Califf in about 1972 or so. There is a virus that infects bacteria called bacteriophage lambda. And in certain mutants of this virus, if you infect the bacterium E. coli, this little virus has two steady states, just like Jacobin Monod's A on, B off, and B on, A off. They happen to be called immunity plus and immunity minus states. What Neubauer and Califf found is that you could take a bacterium in the immunity plus state and culture it for hundreds of generations, and it would stay in the immunity plus state. But every now and then, a few of the cells in this clone of cells would jump to the immunity minus state. So it would be like going from A on, B off to B on, A off. That's an expression of the intrinsic noise in the cell. That tells me that as a working hypothesis, we can really think of cell types as attractors, but they're noisy, and they sometimes will jump to a different cell type. So is there any evidence for that? And the answer is, yes, there is. There is a phenomenon known to biologists but not talked about very much called metaplasia, which I will define in a moment. In your normal development from the fertilized egg, you followed branching pathways of differentiation that gave rise to the different cell types in you. It turns out that sometimes cell types just jump fates in bizarre ways. For example, you can wind up with a bit of stomach in your nose. I don't know what it's good for. Okay, I mean, I suppose you can, you know, digest what you're smelling. You can deal with bacon in a new and eclectic way. You can also get a bit of stomach in your intestine or in your pancreas. Or for the women in the room, you can get a bit of ovary in your stomach. So these are metaplasias, and often they're macroscopic enough that they can be picked up readily on gross dissection at death. So these are metaplasias, and there's two important facts about them. The patterns of jumps that happen are not the patterns of changes that are the normal pathways of differentiation. There's another neighborhood relationship among cell types that is not the normal pathway of differentiation, that is revealing something to us about the neighborhood relationship given noise in cells. Well, if that's true, there should be micrometaplasias. Well, indeed, there are micrometaplasias. In fact, Chris Davis, who is sitting in the front row, who is my research assistant and hoped to be a graduate student soon, and I were talking about this the other day, and we said, gee, if this is right, there should be micrometaplasias. And within 3 days, Chris had found articles in which people are finding that if you look in the pancreas of people, you sometimes find a nest of liver cells. If you look in the liver, you sometimes find a little nest of pancreatic cells. So meanwhile, there are what's called transdifferentiation, which is another term for metaplasias. For example, myoblasts, which give rise to muscles, can jump and give rise to adipocytes, which give rise to fat. I'd rather it went the other way, actually. Okay, particularly now that I'm 65 and I'm overweight. I'd like all the fat in me. Marv, help me with this, okay? Okay. Well, I want all the fat to go to muscle. So, you know, I'm 35 years old and in better shape than I am now, particularly without exercising. I think that's an ideal. There's another cell type that's a normal blood cell called a monocyte. And believe it or not, this monocyte can differentiate into liver cells, into heart cells, and into brain cells. So there are these funny jumps going on. Now, there's a reason why we care about this. But first, I have to tell you some theory. We want to understand this genetic regulatory net. There are two theory approaches that I want to mention to you. One is that for 45 years, or 43 years, or longer than I care to remember, I've been making models of genetic regulatory nets where, for example, you think of all of the genes as having the same number of inputs as all of the other genes, or you think that the genes have some sort of what's called a scale-free distribution of inputs, which is known as a power law, where most genes have few inputs and a few genes have a lot of inputs or outputs. There's growing evidence that real genetic networks are scale-free networks. Or it may be the case that some genes regulate one another, but there's a lot of genes that are regulated but not regulating. So let me define a Medusa network as a network with a head of genes that regulate one another and then a tail of genes that are regulated but not regulating. Now, you take these models and then you deduce properties from them. For example, if I change the activity of a single gene, how many other genes change their activities? Well, out of 30,000 genes, it could be 10 or 15 or a few hundred, or it could be 10 or 20,000. It turns out that these networks behave in two regimes, an ordered regime and a chaotic regime, and it would take me 20 minutes to explain it to you. It's an attractive hypothesis that cells are in an ordered dynamical regime, where you predict that if you alter the activity of a single gene, a few hundred genes change activities. The most recent data supports that hypothesis. Ilya Smulevich, part of the Virtual Institute of which I spoke, and I have recently completed a paper analyzing the time series activities of a certain cancer cell type, and that time series looks like it's consistent with cells being in the ordered regime. The second theoretical problem is the following. There's something called gene expression arrays. Remember, genes make RNA make protein. It's now possible to look simultaneously at the activity of 30,000 genes. Again, there are people in this room who know more about gene arrays than I do. Now, imagine that you have a cell that's differentiating from cell type A to cell type B. Take time slices every 10 minutes or every half hour or so and do a gene array, and you will watch some genes going up in activities and making more RNA, other genes going down in activity making less RNA, some genes oscillating, other genes doing whatever they do. Now, stitch together all of these single-moment snapshots into a, say you have 50 of these snapshots into a movie of the genes going up and down over time. The inverse problem is the following. I show you the movie and you tell me which genes regulate which genes and by what logic that drives the dynamical behavior of that network so that the genes go up and down in that activity. This is a second vast theoretical area that's opening up. Now, I want to tell you that on my flight up here on February 1st, just exactly as we crossed into Canadian airspace, not a moment before, I had a really bright idea. And I thought, God, it's great being a Canadian. I love this. You know, if I stay here, maybe I'll have two bright ideas. And I was really excited about it. And I found Randy at the faculty club. And I said, Randy, I got this really bright idea. And he listened to me and he said, gee, that's actually a bright idea. And so we planned what we were going to do with it. Well, as fate would have it, some other people had the same bright idea a year ago, and they've done wonderful things with it. It is the first clue that we can solve the inverse problem. And one is, if you're a computer scientist, you say, how hard's the problem? It scales as the number of genes cubed. And that means we're going to have to do for 30,000 something, not like 900 trillion calculations. That's just doable. It may require parallelization. So we are working on what we hope is an improvement to this algorithm, because I want to beat the guys at Columbia. What the heck? I'm competitive. Okay, but they have the credit for it. They did it before me. Now, experiments. I want to start with what we've got going now in collaboration with people at MD Anderson in Houston. There is a cancer cell called HL60. It's a leukemic cell line. It is known that if you take this cell and treat it with vitamin A, it differentiates into a perfectly normal blood cell called a polymorphoneutrophil. The experiment that we're doing down at MD Anderson, to make it simple, is to treat cells with different doses and durations of all trans retinoic acid and asking the cells, do you get committed to differentiate or not? And we can tell that by what's called a cell surface marker, then sort the committed cells from the non-committed cells via this cell surface marker, and then ask for the cells that are committed, take the time slices of the genes turning on and off, therefore have the movie, therefore have the data for the algorithm that I told you about. For the cells that aren't committed, we can say, do you go back to the HL60 pattern? And if so, then we're showing that that attractor, which we hope it is, a steady state attractor, is stable to perturbations, which is the essence of homeostasis. And we can ask how many genes change activity. What does the avalanches look like? So we plan those kinds of experiments. They're underway now. Now, notice that what I just told you is identical to asking about, for example, neural stem cells. I hope to meet Sam Weiss in the next couple of weeks. He identified neural stem cells. Neural stem cells differentiate into three main types of neural cells. So imagine doing the same kind of experiment on neural stem cells, using cocktails to control which way the stem cells differentiate, and asking the same question. So we're proposing to do that. These are hard but bread and butter experiments. They should work. There's no new radical science in doing them. There's just grunt work to make it happen. And I know how hard grunt work is. The saying is in experimental biology, it takes three times as long as you think, even after you've allowed for the fact that it takes three times as long. And I've done experiments for you know, 25 or 30 years, and that's an underestimate. So the easy experiments will not be so easy. Now the stem cells again. If stem cells can differentiate, part of what I would like to do, and I think others are doing it too, is to screen collections of small molecules to try to find molecules that control which way stem cells differentiate. In this, I have two pathways forward. I recently have started a company, Genesis Molecular Discovery, based on a patent application of mine to make large collections of small molecules and very bright ideas of my co-founders to make what are called libraries of small molecules and screen them. And I hope to get libraries from Genesis if we can work out a third-party agreement with my new company, and Dennis Salahab is kindly taking on trying to negotiate that. At least I hope he is, because I don't want to negotiate it. So I hope to be in collaboration with Genesis to get libraries to screen. But if we can't with Genesis, there are other companies that supply libraries of small molecules, like, I've forgotten the name, but I'll remember it in a minute. But anyway, you can get libraries from other sources. Which brings us to cancer. Okay, so as I told you, HL60 is already a cancer cell that differentiates if you treat it with all trans retinoic acid. I think I mentioned that there's already a chemical available which, if you put it into a cream and put it on a basal cell carcinoma, it makes the basal cell carcinoma go away in 3 or 4 days, causes the cells to die. So people are now treating leukemias with vitamin A. And this new field of differentiation therapy is opening up with lots of smart people working in it. We intend to take two approaches to it in the Institute. One is to use cell assays and screen libraries of molecules We have to get smart about it. If we want to screen millions of molecules, we can't do them one at a time. We're going to have to hope that we can screen hundreds of molecules at once and then deconvolve anything that looks hopeful to find the molecule that did it. I don't know whether that's possible or not. I don't know that anybody's tried it. That's new science. It may well fail. Meanwhile, Chris Davis and I have come up with an invention that I've described to Dennis Salahab. We are working on filing a patent application on it. It is in the general area of differentiation therapy. I would like to tell you in detail what it's about, but I have to file a patent first. And I have to do that to protect the patent so that I can protect the University of Calgary and the freedom of action of the Institute. So let me just tell you, here's where scientists say we're cautiously optimistic, but it's going to take 10 years of hard work. That's true. It may take 20 years of hard work. But we're also human beings, and frankly, I'm pretty excited about what we're thinking about. The final thing I want to say is there really are commercial possibilities coming out from all of this. First of all, in my own case, I have two biotech companies that are extant that I have founded, and I see collaborations between the Institute and these two companies, one of which will test predictions about which genes regulate which genes, and the other of which, Genesis, will supply libraries to screen. But it may be that this patent that Chris and I have come up with will be broad enough in its impact that it will be intelligent to form a new company to try to exploit that technology. Why do we care in Alberta? We care in Alberta because this whole area, my efforts and the efforts of many others, does in fact stand astride 21st century medicine. It really does. It's not a joke. We use blunderbusses to treat cancer now. It's a heck of a lot better than dying straight away. But they're still blunderbusses. We kill dividing cells. How much better if we can find specific reagents that specifically take colorectal cancer and take those cancer cells and say, would you please go back to being either a colorectal cell or maybe a pancreatic cell? I mean, I don't mind if I have a little bit of pancreas in my colon. I'd much rather that than colorectal cancer. Okay, so I think that in the next 15, 20 years, this area of differentiation therapy is going to flower. How big a role it will play in cancer therapy, it's too early to tell. My suspicion is it will play a quite large role. And we hope to add our efforts to this field. We hope to make Alberta and Canada proud. Thank you all.